Sebastian walked along the stalls of Covent Market. The icy, ferocious cold still held the city in its grip, but the roads from the countryside were finally passable enough that some supplies were beginning to trickle in. She used to be an opera dancer before Ambrose set her up in rooms in Tavistock Street. Almost no one knows about her. He must be extraordinarily discreet in his visits to her.
"He couldn't afford to have his wife find out," said Sebastian,
his gaze scanning the shivering, desperate crowd.
"Not when she was the one actually writing his operas."
"Was she really?"
"She was indeed.
How long has Ambrose had this woman in keeping?"
3 years.
3 years? He has been discreet.
Cat put out a hand, stopping him as she lowered her voice.
"That's her. There. In the cherry red police."
Sebastian studied the woman who stood at a stall mounded high with carrots and potatoes. She was a tiny thing, surely no more than 19 or 20, with a pretty round face and dusky curls that peeked from beneath a fur-trimmed hat. As she turned away from the stall, her pelisse flared open, exposing a heavily pregnant belly.
"Good God," he said softly. "She's with child."
Chapter 39 Edward Ambrose buried his wife beside her sons in the crypt of their parish church of St. Anne's, Soho. He played the part of the grieving widower to perfection, Sebastian thought, watching him. The man's features were drawn and pallid, his shoulders slumped as if beneath a crushing weight of pain and loss. He accepted the condolences of friends and colleagues with a graciousness that impressed everyone who saw him. But if Sebastian's suspicions were correct, the show of grief was all for effect, all false. Sebastian stood beneath the church's west gallery and watched the funeral service. Built by Wren, or one of his associates, in the aftermath of the Great Fire, St. Anne's was a classic basilica, broad and spacious and plain, although cluttered with the high ornate box pews of the parish's wealthier families. He noticed that Jane's brother, Christian Somerset, came in just before the beginning of the service and left immediately afterward, slipping quietly away without attempting to join those who stayed to console his brother-in-law. Women did not typically attend funerals, but it occurred to Sebastian, as he watched Ambrose shake hands and speak quietly to the somber files of men who had come to pay their respects to Jane's husband, just how sad and lonely her life must have been. All the members of her family, except for Christian Somerset, were dead. The real genius behind the operas of Edward Ambrose was hers. Yet, with the exception of the social philosopher, William Godwin, all those attending her funeral were her husband's friends, associates, and admirers. Sebastian waited while the church emptied of mourners, and Ambrose paused to speak in low-voiced consultation with the rector. After a moment, Ambrose nodded to the vicar and walked over to Sebastian to say bluntly,
"I take it you wish to speak to me."
"It can wait until you're finished here," said Sebastian.
"No. If you've something you wish to say to me, say it to me now. Why not? It's only my wife's funeral."
"All right," said Sebastian.
"I know about Emma Carter."
It occurred to Sebastian, watching him, that Ambrose had as much control over his expression as any actor on the stage. Sebastian waited while the dramatist absorbed the implications of Sebastian's words, considered denying all knowledge of the woman, then decided simply to say nothing. And none of those ruminations showed on his face.
Sebastian said, "I'll give you this. You've been extraordinarily careful in your dealings with her. But then you had to be, didn't you, given that your success depended on your wife?"
Ambrose threw an anxious glance over his shoulder at the waiting vicar.
"Why here, for God's sake?" he asked in an angry undertone. "Why now? You bring this up at my wife's funeral? Have you no decency?" "Decency?"
Sebastian felt an absurd impulse to laugh.
"You know what I think? I think Jane found out about your mistress, your pregnant mistress,
I think she threatened to leave you, and you flew into a rage and killed her.
You son of a bitch, hissed Ambrose. I did not kill my wife.
Sebastian studied the other man's handsome, even-featured face.
I don't believe you.
Ambrose threw another worried glance in the direction of the vicar.
Jane did not know about Emma. She didn't even suspect.
Sebastian shook his head.
I keep thinking, what would it do to a woman who just lost both of her own children to then learn that her husband had got another woman quick with child? I was always careful. Always.
Perhaps. But that doesn't mean someone didn't tell her. Someone who wished you harm. You or her.
You're wrong, I tell you. Do you understand me? Wrong!
Perhaps. Sebastian turned to go, then paused to say, Tell me this. Did your wife have a particular friend? Someone in whom she might have confided?
Someone who knows the shadowy recesses of her life which might hold the secret to her tragic death.
Ambrose shook his head.
No, not really.
You're certain?
Not to my knowledge.
But then, how well did you actually know your wife?
What the hell is that supposed to mean?
Think about it, said Sebastian, and walked away. Sebastian sat for a time in the quiet of St. Anne's churchyard and watched a few lazy snowflakes fall to earth, his thoughts drifting haphazardly from one aspect of Jane Ambrose's death to the next. He'd been coming around to thinking that the threat to Jane's life had come from outside her home, from someone such as Rothschild, Jarvis, or Van der Pals. But like so many women, Jane had lived with a man who had no hesitation in taking his frustration and anger out on her with his fists. Debt, infidelity, jealousy, and rage were a potent brew that all too often could lead to death. The problem was, if Ambrose had killed his wife, why that Thursday? And where? It seemed to make no sense. Which meant Sebastian was still missing something. Frustrated, Sebastian walked to Christian Somerset's establishment on Paternoster Row, only to find the bookstore closed and the printing workshop deserted, except for a sandy-haired, rosy-cheeked lad of perhaps 15, who was cleaning dirty type, his arms black with ink up to the elbows.
"Mr. Somerset and the other lads are all at the Frost Fair," said the young apprentice with a grin. "You ought to see our booth. It's ever so grand."
Christian Somerset had set up his booth midway between Blackfriars and London Bridge on the Frost Fair's main promenade. It was indeed an impressive structure, painted with craggy cliffs and fairyland castles beneath a pastel sky, and stocked with a fine collection of romances, poetry volumes, and packets of feminine stationery. For a penny, fairgoers could also buy a souvenir memento that carried a crude image of the Frost Fair above the Lord's Prayer, with "Printed on the Thames, 1814, Frost Fair," emblazoned in large type below it. Christian Somerset himself was personally working the press.
"Somehow I didn't expect to find you here," said Sebastian, walking up to him.
Jane's brother rotated the press's handle to roll the bed under the platen, and gave one of his slow, self-deprecating smiles.
"This frozen river is minting money. A man would need to be a fool to miss this kind of opportunity."
He paused to turn the screw's long handle.
"I even dragged my old wooden press out of the basement for the occasion. I was afraid if I brought one of the new iron-framed Stanhopes out here, it would crash through the ice and drown us all."
He nodded to a nearby apprentice to take his place at the press, his smile fading as they stepped away from the booth.
"I saw you at Jane's funeral."
"Allow me to express my condolences again on the loss of your sister," said Sebastian. Somerset nodded and had to look away for a moment, blinking.
"Have you learned something new?"
"I've discovered you were right. Ambrose does indeed have a mistress. An opera dancer he keeps in rooms in Tavistock Street." Somerset's jaw tightened.
"I knew it, the bloody bastard.
What would Jane have done, do you think, if she found out? Would she have left him?
Somerset shook his head.
Not Jane. Not even if she discovered his mistress was heavy with his child.
My God, is she?
Yes.
Somerset stared thoughtfully at a group of men drinking rum and grog around a nearby bonfire.
I still don't think she'd leave him, even with both her children now dead. She might threaten it in the heat of the moment, but she'd never actually do it.
The question is, would Ambrose know that?
Somerset frowned.
Perhaps not. Did you know Jane wrote the music for all of Ambrose's operas?
Somerset blinked.
I always suspected she helped him, although she would never admit it, at least not to me. She didn't simply help. The music was hers.
He blew out his breath in a long, pained sigh.
Poor Jane. To think of the acclaim that could have been hers, had she only been born a man.
Did she feel it, do you think?
Jane's brother rubbed his eyes with a splayed thumb and forefinger.
She must have.
Growing up, we all knew she was actually more talented than her twin, James. Even he acknowledged it. Our father tolerated her playing, but he never actually encouraged her the way he did James. People were always complimenting her for playing like a man. I know that used to anger her. But she never said anything to me about Ambrose's music, if that's what you're asking. She was a very private person, Jane. Do you know if she had any close female friends? Our sister, Jilly, was just a year older than Jane, and they were quite close. But Jilly died a couple of years ago, consumption. Is there no one else? Not that I know of, sorry.
Sebastian watched one of the men drinking rum by the fire stagger to his feet, only to fall flat on the ice.
You say Jane would never have left Ambrose because of the way your father raised her. But even fiercely devout people can lose their faith, particularly after the deaths of two dearly beloved children. She might have changed her mind.
Somerset shook his head.
Not Jane.
Liam Maxwell begged her to leave Ambrose right after Lawrence died, and she wouldn't do it. She said she'd made a vow before God, and just because she later realized it was a mistake, didn't give her the right to forsake that vow. I can't see the discovery that Ambrose had a mistress, even an enceinte mistress, changing that.
Sebastian felt the wind cold against his cheek.
Are you saying that your sister and Maxwell were lovers? Because just a few days ago you insisted Jane would never be unfaithful to her husband.
Somerset looked troubled, as if he regretted what he'd said.
No, I didn't mean to imply that at all. Jane would never have been unfaithful to Ambrose, I'm certain of that. But there's no denying that Maxwell has been in love with her for years. And while she never admitted as much to me, I've often thought Jane felt the same.
Did Ambrose know?
I suppose he might have suspected it, but I couldn't say for certain.
He's so wrapped up in himself, it's possible he never noticed. Although if he did...
Somerset broke off.
If he did, prompted Sebastian.
Somerset thrust his hands deep into his pockets and shivered, as if suddenly feeling the cold.
A man like Ambrose. I don't imagine he'd take it well, knowing his wife was in love with another man. Even if he didn't believe they were lovers.
Sebastian kept turning Somerset's words over and over in his mind as he worked his way through the Frost Fair's surging crowds. It certainly provided an easy explanation for what had happened. It was an old, familiar tragedy. A woman discovers her husband is unfaithful, they argue. The husband, himself already suspicious of her infidelity, strikes her in anger and accidentally kills her. Could it really be that simple?
Could all the dangerous undercurrents in Jane Ambrose's life, her discovery of the financial manoeuvrings of the Rothschilds, and the political machinations surrounding Princess Charlotte, simply be a distraction?
It was possible.
It might even seem the inevitable solution if it weren't for the questions raised by the murder of Valentino Vescovi. But if it were true, then why the devil had Liam Maxwell, a man who claimed he wanted to catch Jane's killer, deliberately kept hidden from Sebastian such an important aspect of her life? By the time Sebastian arrived at the upper end of the Frost Fair's grand promenade, his feet were cold, and he was in no mood to tolerate any more of the printer's evasive games. But Maxwell's booth was being manned by three apprentices. Maxwell himself was nowhere in sight.
"He went off a good long while ago," said one of the apprentices,
inking the press's text block.
"Didn't say where he was going."
"You're certain? This is important." The two younger apprentices shook their heads, their expressions believably blank. But the oldest lad hesitated a moment, then said,
"I think he went off on account of that lady's funeral. But I can't tell you where he went any more than Richard and Paul here."
"Thank you," said Sebastian. The lad simply stared back at him, his face taut and troubled. Leaving the river, Sebastian climbed the hill to Maxwell's printing shop in a cluttered ancient court off Fleet Street. It was a far different establishment from that of his former partner, cramped and dirty, with no elegant bookshop and bindery attached. But the workroom was locked up and deserted. After that, Sebastian tried every public room and tavern in the area, all without success. Liam Maxwell obviously didn't want to be found. The whistled refrain of what sounded suspiciously like Alastair McCullough, an old Irish rebel song, floated across the snow-filled yard as Sebastian ploughed his way to the door of the surgeon's stone outbuilding. He banged on the old warped panels and Gibson broke off to shout, "Go away! I'm busy!" Sebastian pushed open the door to find the Irishman leaning against the stone slab in the centre of the room, a saw in one hand. The only thing on the table before him was a human leg neatly sliced in two just above the knee.
"Ah, that's you," said Gibson, setting aside the saw with a clatter. "Thought it might be someone I didn't want seeing this."
"What is that?
And what does it look like, then?" said Gibson, reaching for a rag to wipe his hands. "It's a leg. I've been practicing a new amputation technique."
"Lovely." Sebastian closed the door against the cold. "I won't ask where you got it." He looked beyond the Irishman to where what was left of Valentino Vescovi rested on a low shelf. "Finished with him, have you?"
"I have."
"Learn anything?
Nothing you didn't know."
Gibson tossed aside the rag. "He was stabbed in the back by someone who either knew what he was doing or got lucky."
"That's it?"
"That's it."
"Bloody hell."
Sebastian slapped one hand against the doorframe.
"How the devil am I supposed to figure out who's doing this?"
"His clothes are there," said Gibson, nodding to the jumbled pile on a nearby shelf. "If you care to go through them." Sebastian had checked the musician's pockets last night while waiting for Lovejoy. But he went over everything again anyway, this time examining the seams and linings as well. He found nothing. "His death might not be related to what happened to Jane Ambrose," said Gibson, watching him. "People really do occasionally get killed by footpads in London." Sebastian carefully folded the harpist's red scarf and rested it atop his serviceable, slightly worn clothing. This wasn't footpads. On his way back to Brook Street, Sebastian decided to swing past the Church of St. Anne's, Soho. And it was there he finally found Liam Maxwell, sitting hunched over at the top of the steep stone steps leading down to the crypt, his hands thrust between his knees, and his face wet with tears that slid unchecked down his cheeks. Chapter 40. The church was bitterly cold and filled with shadows, for the morning's weak sunshine had long since disappeared behind a thick cover of heavy white clouds. Sebastian went to stand with his hands braced against the crypt's iron railing, his nostrils filling with the scent of dank stone and old death. Liam Maxwell did not look up, but after a moment he drew a shaky breath and said,
"I can't believe she's down there.
I can't believe she's down there dead, and I'll never see her again.
His voice cracked.
How can that be?
Sebastian shook his head, for there was no answer to give.
Why didn't you admit you were in love with her, and she with you?
Maxwell squeezed his eyes shut.
I don't know. I didn't want you to get the wrong idea about her, about the kind of woman she was.
It was possible, Sebastian thought. But he could also think of another explanation that was considerably more damning.
Were you lovers?
Maxwell swiped his sleeve across his wet eyes.
No. I swear to God, no. Yet you asked her to leave her husband. Who told you that? Is it true?
The journalist hesitated, then nodded.
She wouldn't do it, though, for all he made her as miserable as a woman can be. How long? How long have you been in love with her?
A ghost of a smile touched his features.
Since the September I was 15. I went with Christian to watch a regatta on the Thames, and she was there. I remember she was wearing a wide-brimmed straw hat and a white muslin dress with little puff sleeves and a blue sash, and I fell hopelessly, irretrievably in love with her, even though she was 20 years old and married, and she treated me like her little brother's awkward school friend, which is precisely what I was.
When did that change?
I don't know. It happened slowly over time. I think if I hadn't been so much younger than she and her brother's friend, it never would have come to be. As it was, it simply crept up on her unawares. When Christian and I were in prison, she used to come see us, and we would talk for hours.
He drew a deep, shuddering breath.
That's when I first realized Ambrose hit her. One time she came, she had a black eye. She refused to admit he'd done it, but Jane never was very good at lying. He was furious with her for visiting her brother in prison.
Maxwell huffed a sound that was not a laugh.
What a bloody bastard. Did you know he's had an opera dancer in keeping for the past 3 years?
Maxwell entwined his fingers together and tapped his joined hands against his mouth.
I suspected it. Did you tell Jane?
No.
Why not?
Because I didn't know for certain.
And because even if it were true, I knew she still wouldn't leave him.
It would only have hurt her to realize that the man she'd given up everything for couldn't even be faithful to her.
Could she have found out?
No.
You're certain?
Yes.
She never would have kept it from me had she known.
Yet she didn't tell you about either Rothschild's gold shipments or his threats, did she?
Maxwell held himself very still.
No. No, she didn't. You said you last saw her on the afternoon before she died. Was that true?
Maxwell nodded.
What exactly did she say to you?
He scrubbed his hands down over his face.
I told you. She talked about Princess Charlotte's betrothal, about what a mistake it would be for Charlotte to go through with the marriage. She said the girl didn't realize how much she would be giving up. And then she said our society asks women to give up too much. But nothing's going to change as long as women keep meekly doing what is expected of them. That doesn't sound like what I've come to know about Jane.
No, not at all.
I asked her what she meant by it. But she only gave me a strange smile, kissed my cheek, and said, "You'll see."
"You'll see?
You'll see what?"
"I don't know."
Sebastian kept his gaze on the younger man's face.
The post-mortem showed Jane had been raped a day or two before she was killed.
"What?"
Maxwell pushed to his feet, his hands curling into fists at his sides.
"She didn't say anything to you about it?"
"No!"
He flung away, only to draw up short and whirl to face Sebastian again.
"Who? Who did it?"
"We don't know." "Was it Ambrose?"
Maxwell's nostrils flared.
"Did he force himself on her, hurt her?
because if it was Ambrose, I swear to God I'll...
Don't, suggested Sebastian quietly.
The journalist thrust a shaky hand through his disheveled hair and swallowed hard. Sebastian said, Is there anyone to whom Jane might have confided something of that nature? Maxwell thought about it a moment, then shook his head.
I can't think of anyone. She was fairly close to Miss Jones, but I doubt she would have revealed it something like that to her.
Women don't usually talk about such things, do they? Not if they can hide it.
Who is Miss Jones?
Lottie Jones. She's the princess's official miniature portrait painter. Jane's knew her for years. She painted the miniatures of Jane's children in her locket. Where would I find her?
She has a studio in Lower Grosvenor Street.
Maxwell slumped back against one of the side aisle's columns, his head falling back as he stared up at the old church's arched ceiling.
I can't believe she kept so much from me. First Rothschild, then this. Why?
Why would she do that?
What would you have done if she had told you someone had forced himself upon her?
Maxwell's jaw clenched.
Killed the bastard.
Sebastian nodded.
Then that's why she didn't tell you.
An early dusk was falling over the city by the time Sebastian turned down Brook Street. He could hear Hero playing the pianoforte, a haunting melody that carried clearly in the cold air as he nodded to the lamplighter and his boy, working to kindle the flame of the oil lamp near the corner. Hero had always been a technically proficient pianist, but there was a quality to her playing on this frigid February evening that he had never heard before. And as he handed his hat, gloves, greatcoat and walking stick to Morrie and turned to climb the stairs, he finally realized what it was. Emotion. Hero typically approached her playing as a skill, a task, something she mastered and yet from which she held herself aloof. But not tonight. Tonight she was pouring herself into her music, and the result was both exquisite and heart-rending. He paused outside the drawing-room door, not wanting to interrupt her. And so engrossed was she in her music that she remained unaware of him watching her until the piece ended and her fingers slipped from the keys to rest in her lap. Then, as if sensing his presence, she turned her head and saw him.
"A beautiful piece," he said, going to rest his hands on her shoulders.
"It's from Lancelot and Guinevere." She leaned back until her head was resting against him. "I keep thinking about all the incredible music Jane gave the world. All that beauty and joy. Yet no one will ever know it's hers. Because she was a woman." He kissed the top of her head and went to pour himself a brandy before coming to sprawl in a nearby chair.
"Are you acquainted with a woman named Lottie Jones?"
Hero swung around on her bench.
"You mean the miniature painter?"
"So you do know her?"
"Not well, but yes, I know her."
"Well enough to ask if she has any idea who might have raped Jane Ambrose."
"Oh, Lord," said Hero, and reached out to take a sip of his brandy.
Thursday, 3rd of February. It was not easy being a woman in London's male-dominated art world. Miss Lottie Jones had succeeded on the strength of her personality as much as her prodigious talent, and by wisely choosing to focus on the one niche of her profession popularly perceived as being particularly suited to women, the painting of miniature portraits on ivory. She was now 45 years old, her appearance striking, her manner deftly calculated to flatter her subject's amour propre without being obsequious. Hero had known the artist for 7 or 8 years, and so Miss Jones received the Viscountess in her studio's private parlour with a warm welcome. But her eyes were watchful and knowing, for this was a woman whose gift for capturing likenesses came as much from her ability to see behind the mask her subjects tried to present to the world as from her skill with brush and tint.
They spoke for a time of the weather, of the progression of the war on the continent, and of an exhibition Miss Jones had planned for the spring. And then, when Hero was still working her way around to the reason for her visit, the artist fixed Hero with a steady gaze and said,
"I've heard the palace is suppressing the truth about Jane Ambrose's death. Is that why you're here, my lady? Because the rumours are true, and you think I might know something of use to Lord Devlin's investigation?"
Hero met the older woman's gaze and held it.
"I understand you and Jane were friends."
Miss Jones gave a sad sigh.
"We were, yes. Our backgrounds might have been dissimilar, but we nonetheless had much in common. We both knew what it was like to be female in a profession that is not friendly to our sex. Not to mention years of experience in dealing with Princess Charlotte and her father."
A gleam of amusement lit up the older woman's shrewd eyes.
"That as well."
The amusement faded.
"But the truth is, I don't see how I can be of much assistance to you. It is possible to know someone quite well in some ways, and yet remain ignorant of the intimate details of her life. I can tell you that the loss of Jane's two boys last year utterly devastated her, that she loved her surviving brother dearly, and still missed her dead siblings and parents dreadfully. But if you were to ask me who might have killed her..."
Her voice trailed away, and she shook her head.
"When was the last time you saw her?"
Miss Jones frowned in thought.
"It must have been a week or more before she died. She came for tea one afternoon, and we spoke of the prince's gout and this new poem of Byron's, but nothing of any real importance."
"How did she seem then?" Miss Jones was silent a moment before answering.
"Actually, she did her best not to show it, but there's no doubt she was preoccupied and unhappy in a way I don't recall her being before. But I couldn't tell you why. As she was leaving, I asked if she were all right, and she simply laughed and said the wretched weather was making her blue-deviled."
"Did she ever say anything to you about someone forcing unwelcome advances upon her? A man, I mean."
The question obviously took the older woman by surprise. "Good heavens! No, never. Although..."
"Yes?" prompted Hero.
The artist folded her hands in her lap and looked down at them.
"Miss Jones?"
She drew a deep breath. "I don't know if this is relevant, but I did see Jane one other time recently. I didn't mention it before, because I didn't actually speak with her. But I was coming out of Warwick House and she was there, in the small receiving room just to the left of the entrance. I was surprised to see her, because it was Tuesday, quite late, and Jane's lessons with Charlotte were always on Monday and Thursday mornings."
"So why was she there?"
"I don't know, but she was engaged in a decidedly heated exchange with Lady Arabella, the Duchess of Leeds' daughter." "Yes. That was strange enough, given that Jane's opinion of the vile, sneaky little girl matched my own. But what was particularly startling was Jane's appearance. She was still wearing her pelisse, and I could see that the back was horribly smeared with some sort of muck, while one sleeve was torn at the seam. Even the flounce of her walking dress was ripped, for I could see it trailing beneath the hem of her pelisse."
She paused.
"If it hadn't been for Lady Arabella, I'd have gone to her. But given the nature of their conversation, I didn't feel it would be right for me to interrupt."
"What were they saying?"
"I didn't hear much. I was trying not to. But I did hear Arabella say something to the effect of, 'You brought this on yourself. How dare you presume to now blame me for your mistakes?'"
Hero leaned forward.
"But you don't know what she was talking about." "No. It was all so awkward. I doubt I'd have asked her about it the next time I saw her. But as it was, I never had the opportunity. 2 days later, she was dead."
Chapter 41
"What the devil do you make of that?" said Devlin, when Hero told him of her conversation with the miniaturist.
"I've not the slightest idea. But it sounds as if we need to have an urgent and brutally frank conversation with young Lady Arabella."
Devlin frowned.
The problem is, how to do it away from Mama Duchess.
Hero pushed up from where she sat to go thumb through the various invitations on the mantelpiece.
I'd utterly forgotten. What's today?
Thursday. Why?
She swung around as she found the one she was looking for.
We have an alfresco breakfast in Kensington Gardens to attend.
In the snow?
In the snow.
The Duchess of Leeds' decision to give a grand wintertime alfresco breakfast had been risky, but inspired. A fresh white blanket of clean snow covered the sprawling lawns and empty flower beds of the royal gardens, while long icicles hung sparkling from the bare branches of the surrounding trees. In addition to tables groaning with food and copious libations of mulled wine, coffee, tea, and hot chocolate, Her Grace had also strewn the snowy gardens with braziers for those most sensitive to the cold. But even the weather cooperated. The day had dawned crystal clear without any wind, and the golden sunlight and dry air made the afternoon surprisingly pleasant despite the actual temperature. Like all society breakfasts, this one was held in the early afternoon, since few members of the ton rolled out of bed before midday. Most of the guests arrived wrapped in furs, and they came in droves, for invitations to the breakfast were highly coveted. Its very sight, the gardens of Kensington Palace, clearly signalled to the world the Dowager Duchess's high standing with the royal family. Not only was the aged queen herself present, but so were four of her spinster daughters and a brace of royal dukes. Even the Prince Regent put in an appearance, still hobbling about with a cane, thanks to his recent attack of gout. The only royal of any significance noticeably absent was the young heiress presumptive to the throne.
"Charlotte," said the Dowager Duchess of Leeds, when Devlin paused beside their hostess to inquire after the princess.
"Oh, His Highness prefers she not attend such affairs."
Hero had to force herself not to meet Devlin's gaze.
"But your daughter, Lady Arabella, is here?"
"Oh, yes," said the Dowager smugly. "She makes her come out this year, you know."
"How lovely," said Hero.
"And you almost sounded as if you meant it," Devlin told Hero as they strolled along snowy paths looking for Lady Arabella.
Hero pulled a face. "Beastly woman." He stared off across the winter-shrouded gardens filled with laughing, chatting guests.
"The other day you compared Charlotte to Rapunzel, but I'm beginning to think a more apt comparison might be Cinderella. Admittedly, no one is making Charlotte sweep out fireplaces, but she certainly is forced to sit home while everyone else is out having fun."
"Except that in Charlotte's case, I fear there will be no Prince Charming in her future to ride to her rescue."
Hero frowned as she scanned the crowd.
"Do you see her little ladyship?"
"There, at the table by the sundial." "Which of us do you think would be most likely to intimidate her into telling the truth?"
"I doubt anyone could intimidate that girl."
"I am larger."
"True. But if she simply refuses to answer your questions?"
"How precisely do you intend to force a 16-year-old duke's daughter to be more forthcoming? In the middle of her mamma's party?"
Devlin thought about it a moment, then said,
"I haven't the slightest idea."
Hero nodded.
"I thought not. Leave her to me."
Lady Arabella was choosing between the relative merits of sliced roast beef and bacon when Hero walked up to her and said bluntly,
"I'm going to ask you some questions about Jane Ambrose, and you are going to answer me truthfully."
The Duke's lovely young daughter gave a trill of laughter.
"Indeed. And if I don't?"
Hero made a show of studying a platter of what must have been hideously expensive greenhouse asparagus.
"It's actually quite ridiculous how easy it is to ruin a young lady's reputation," she said, in a pleasant conversational tone. "A little whisper here, an innuendo there, and the opprobrium quickly takes on a life of its own, whether it's true or not. And even when the young lady in question is the daughter of a duke."
Lady Arabella's beautifully moulded lips curved into an arrogant smile.
I don't believe you would do that.
Hero met the girl's glittering gaze and held it.
Oh, believe me, I would.
It was the girl who looked away first, her nostrils flaring on a quickly indrawn breath. Hero said, Something happened to Jane Ambrose the Tuesday before she died. Something dreadful.
And you know what it was.
Lady Arabella lifted her chin. She was no longer smiling.
I'm afraid I haven't the slightest idea what you could be referring to.
Yes, you do. She came to Warwick House right afterward, specifically to confront you about it.
If you know so much about it, then why bother asking me?
Don't, said Hero, her voice low and lethal. Don't even think about trying my patience any further.
The girl's pointed little chin jerked up higher.
Very well. She came because, or so she claimed, the Dutch courtier Peter van der Pauls had forced himself upon her, and she had the ridiculous notion in her head that I was responsible.
The girl gave another tinkling little laugh that made Hero long to slap her beautiful, spoiled face.
As if I could somehow be held to blame for her folly.
You don't think you were?
Hardly.
Van der Pauls threatened to make her sorry if she told anyone he'd tried to get her to spy for him.
I know you overheard her warning Ella Kinsworth about what he'd done, because you later repeated the conversation to Valentino Vescovi. Did you also tattle to van der Pauls himself?
And if I did?
He raped her because of you.
So she claimed.
Oh, it happened.
The girl simply stared back at Hero, jaw set hard. Hero said,
Where did the rape take place?
I've no idea. Do you seriously think I inquired into the sordid details?
Hero searched the young girl's lovely, cold face.
Two people are dead, in all likelihood because of you. Don't you even care?
I am no more responsible for their deaths than you are.
Hero shook her head. But all she could find to say was, May God have mercy on your soul. She was turning away when Lady Arabella said,
Mrs. Ambrose actually thanked me, you know.
Hero paused. For what?
She said, I'd helped her see something she should have realized long ago.
And what was that?
I haven't the slightest idea. I didn't ask her for particulars.
Hero said, If you know anything else, anything at all, about what happened to Jane Ambrose or Valentino Vescovi.
I've told you all I know.
Lady Arabella shook back her dark, beautiful hair.
Now, you must excuse me, Lady Devlin. I see my mother, the Duchess, looking for me.
And with that, the girl slipped away, her head held high, and a faint smile curling her lovely lips. Secure in the knowledge that her wealth, birth, and beauty would insulate her from the myriad ugly fates that could befall the world's less exalted mortals. Chapter 42 Peter van der Pauls was looking over a tray of snuff boxes in an exclusive little shop on Bond Street when Sebastian came to rest one forearm on the counter beside him.
Leave us,
Sebastian told the slight, fastidious shopkeeper hovering nearby. The shopkeeper took his tray of snuff boxes and scuttled to the back of the shop. Van der Pauls turned with deliberate indolence to face Sebastian.
I presume you are here as a result of Lady Devlin's conversation with the Duchess of Leeds' daughter? Lady Arabella managed to get word to you about that already, did she? And are you planning to deny what you did to Jane Ambrose?
The Dutchman gave a low, incredulous laugh.
Hardly. Why should I? I warned her to keep her mouth shut, and she did not. You think that justifies what you did to her?
The courtier shrugged and started to turn away.
I taught the bitch a lesson. She had it coming.
Sebastian caught van der Pauls by the shoulder and spun him around to shove him back against the nearest wall hard enough to rattle the contents of the display cases.
Gentlemen, bleated the shopkeeper,
clutching his tray of snuff-boxes against his chest. "Gentlemen, please!"
Vanderpals held himself very still. "You are physically assaulting the particular friend of a man who will some day be the prince consort of your queen, if not king, in his own name. I'll worry about the consequences when that day comes."
The courtier raised one supercilious eyebrow.
"What precisely is it you want from me?"
"Answers. First of all, where did this happen?"
"Savile Row. I believe she was coming back from a visit to her dear Uncle Sheridan, but I could have that wrong."
"So you what? Dragged her into a convenient alley and took her there up against a wall?"
"Something like that. It was, after all, an act of punishment, not pleasure."
Sebastian resisted the urge to slam the man against the wall again.
"And then 2 days later you killed her?" "Hardly. I'd already made my point." "Why would I then kill her?"
"For refusing to keep quiet about the rape."
"In my experience, women never talk about such incidents. They understand that for others to know what's been done to them is far more damaging than the initial violation, and therefore keep silent for their own good."
"Except that Jane Ambrose wasn't keeping silent. And given your friendship with young Lady Arabella, I have no doubt you know that."
The courtier gave a dismissive shrug. "So, she told one 16-year-old girl. She wouldn't have told anyone else."
Sebastian studied the man's handsome, self-assured face.
"This isn't the first time you've done something like this, is it?"
The courtier shrugged again, his smile never slipping.
Sebastian's fists closed on the man's lapels. "You son of a gentleman, please!"
Sebastian threw a quick look at the shopkeeper, then took a step back and let the courtier go.
Vanderpals carefully adjusted his coat. "If you ask me," he said, his attention all for his clothing, "the husband killed her."
"Oh? And is this wild speculation on your part, or are you actually basing it on something?"
Vanderpals frowned as he studied his reflection in a nearby mirror and swiftly repaired the folds of his cravat. "Call it a logical deduction. You see, I told her about her husband's young mistress, his enceinte young mistress."
"How the bloody hell did you know about that?"
"It's my business to know such things. I even gave her the girl's name and address."
"Why?"
"Why what?"
"Why did you do that?"
The courtier gave a wide smile that showed his white, even teeth. "Because I knew it would hurt her. Why else?"
The smile faded. "In the past, out of my respect for my prince, I have allowed your insults to my honour to slide. But such an outrage will not go unavenged."
Sebastian turned away.
"You can try."
Chapter 43 Sebastian's knock at the door of the rooms Edward Ambrose kept for his mistress in Tavistock Street was answered by a young housemaid no more than 12 or 13 years old. She was a gangly thing, all arms and legs, with a head of rioting dark hair inadequately constrained by a mob cap. She was evidently so surprised to see an unknown gentleman standing at her mistress's door that she simply stared at him, mouth agape.
"Is your mistress at home?" said Sebastian.
The girl closed her mouth and nodded, eyes going wide. Sebastian handed her his card.
"Kindly tell her Lord Devlin would like a word."
"Who is it, Molly?"
Emma Carter came from a distant room, training a length of delicate white knitting. At the sight of Sebastian, she drew up abruptly.
"Oh,"
she said, her free hand creeping up to cup her heavy belly. The way she was looking at him told Sebastian she not only knew who he was, but also had some idea as to why he was here. She wore a high-waisted figured muslin gown with long sleeves and a pink shawl, and she looked lovely, frightened, and very, very young. Her accent was good enough to make Sebastian wonder what had brought her to this. He said,
"If I might have a word with you, Miss Carter. I need to ask you some questions about Jane Ambrose."
"But I don't know anything about what happened to her,"
she whispered, her nostrils flaring with alarm.
I swear it.
Did she come here last Tuesday or Wednesday?
Emma Carter and her housemaid exchanged quick, anxious glances.
Sebastian said, "She did, didn't she? What did she say?"
The young woman's breathing had become so agitated she was shaking with it. Her lips parted, but she seemed to find it impossible to say anything.
"Miss Carter, what did she say?"
It was the housemaid who answered.
"She didn't say nothing. She just stood there and looked at Mistress. Then she whirled around and left."
"That's it."
Mistress and housemaid both nodded.
"Did you tell Edward Ambrose she had come?"
Emma Carter shook her head no, even as her housemaid was nodding yes.
"When did you tell him?" demanded Sebastian, his gaze hard upon her, even as her features crumpled with her tears. "And don't even think about lying to me again."
"The next day, Wednesday,"
said the young woman in a broken voice.
"Wednesday evening."
"And did you see him again that Thursday?"
"No. He was supposed to come in the afternoon, but he didn't."
"Did he ever tell you why not?"
"He said something came up. He didn't tell me what."
"Thank you," said Sebastian. As he turned away, he found himself wondering what would happen to this heavily pregnant young woman if the father of her unborn child were convicted of murdering his wife. Then he caught the horror in Emma Carter's frightened brown eyes, and he knew the same thought had already occurred to her. Sebastian walked the icy streets of the city, his thoughts turning over everything he'd just learned and everything he thought he'd known before. In the last month of a life cut tragically short, Jane Ambrose had inadvertently made some nasty, formidable enemies. Lord Jarvis, Nathan Rothschild, and the courtier, Peter Vanderpals. All were hard men who wouldn't hesitate to kill a beautiful young pianist if she got in their way. She had moved through a dangerous swirl of greed and palace intrigue that Sebastian suspected he still didn't completely understand. But he was coming increasingly to suspect that her death might actually have been the result of forces that were, for the most part, considerably more personal. What would happen, he wondered, if a woman who'd recently buried both her children were to discover that her husband was about to have a child by his young mistress, a mistress he maintained in grand style, on money earned from the operas she herself had secretly written. What would she do? Sebastian found himself coming back to what Jane had told Liam Maxwell the afternoon before she died. "Our society asks women to give up too much, but nothing is going to change as long as we keep meekly doing what is expected of us." When Sebastian first heard those words, they struck him as oddly out of character for the woman he thought he was coming to know. But that was before he'd learned all that had happened to Jane Ambrose in the 24 hours before that strange conversation. From Vanderpals's brutal rape in the Savile Row alley to her discovery of her husband's pregnant mistress. When considered in that context, Jane's statement to Liam Maxwell sounded like the dawning resolution of a woman who'd had enough. Who'd had enough of hiding her talent from the world because of her sex. Who was weary of denying a love that had been slowly deepening over 10 long years. Who no longer believed she should endure a loveless marriage to an abusive husband simply because that's what her religion and society expected of a wife. So what had she done? Sebastian wondered. Confronted Ambrose? Threatened to leave him? It wasn't difficult to imagine how a man such as Edward Ambrose, deeply in debt and known for hitting his wife, would react. And if he hit her hard enough that she fell and fatally struck her head? A man like Ambrose would never admit what he'd done. The housemaid who answered the door of Ambrose's Soho Square townhouse looked less sorrowful than the last time Sebastian had seen her, but more anxious.
"My lord," she said, bobbing a quick curtsy, "if you're here to see Mr. Ambrose, he's in his library. He's been in there forever, but he don't take kindly to us interrupting him when he's working like this, and I don't dare disturb him."
"That's quite all right,"
Sebastian said pleasantly, as he simply walked past her toward the library door. I'll interrupt him myself.
But my lord...
She broke off in a gasp and threw her apron up over her face as Sebastian thrust open the door without knocking. It was the unexpected chill that hit him first, the chill and the ripe smell of blood. Edward Ambrose lay sprawled on his back beside the library's cold hearth, one knee bent awkwardly beneath him, his arms flung out at his sides. His mouth was slightly agape, his eyes wide as if he were startled by something. But the eyes were already filmed and flattening, and a dark sea of blood stiffened the front of the torn white silk waistcoat, from which protruded the handle of an elegant dagger. The housemaid, who had crept up to peek around Sebastian's side, dropped her apron and began to scream. Chapter 44
"How long do you think he's been dead?"
asked Lovejoy, sometime later as he crouched beside the dead man. Sebastian stood with one hand braced against the nearby mantelpiece.
"Quite a while, from the looks of things. Much of the blood has dried, and the fire has burnt itself down to ashes. According to the housemaid, he shut himself in here shortly after breakfast, and no one in the household had seen him since. Not even to bring him a cup of tea. She said he didn't like to be disturbed. Someone obviously disturbed him."
Lovejoy pushed to his feet with a stifled grunt as his knees creaked. He turned in a slow circle, taking in the room's gently worn furnishings and scattered musical instruments. Jane Ambrose's basket of mending still rested beside her chair.
"There doesn't seem to be any sign of either an altercation or a search."
"No." Lovejoy sighed.
"I'll set some of the lads to go in over the house. We might find something."
"Perhaps," agreed Sebastian, although he doubted it. Lovejoy brought his gaze back to the dagger protruding from the dead man's chest. It was an exotic weapon, the nephrite handle gently curved to fit comfortably in the palm, and set with pearls and semi-precious stones.
"An unusual piece." "It looks Indian to me. Probably Mughal," said Sebastian.
And left it at that. Dusk was falling by the time Sebastian made it back to St. Anne's, Soho. Liam Maxwell was not there. He checked the journalist's printing shop, then his booth at the Frost Fair, and drew a blank both places. Frustrated, he turned his steps toward Tower Hill. As he crossed Gibson's snowy yard, he could see the glow of a lantern shining through the high windows of the surgeon's stone outbuilding to cast a warm pool of golden light into the night. But when Sebastian pushed open the door, the Irishman was just tugging off Ambrose's boots.
"Bloody hell," said Gibson, looking up. "I hope you aren't already expecting me to know anything about this latest corpse you've sent. Lovejoy's men just delivered him."
Sebastian grunted.
"Let me see the dagger, at least."
Gibson shifted to carefully ease the weapon from the dead man's chest, his eyes narrowing as he studied the inlaid handle.
"Looks Mughal. That's what I was thinking. It also looks like a woman's weapon."
Sebastian took the knife in his hand and frowned.
"Yes."
It was an exquisite piece of work, the blade curved with a central ridge and Damascene floral decoration near the hilt, and a floral motif of inlaid pearls and red and green stones on the pommel. Gibson was watching him carefully.
"Do I take it that means something to you?" "Maybe. Maybe not."
"Well," said Gibson, exaggerating his brogue, "it's a relief, it is, knowing you've narrowed things down a bit."
He tugged off the second boot.
"Since you're here, you might as well help me strip the fellow.
Your eyes are better in this light than mine, anyway." Whoever killed Edward Ambrose had stabbed him 3 times.
"Doesn't look like this killer knew what he was doing," said Sebastian,
staring at the 3 jagged gashes in the dead man's now naked torso.
"Doesn't, does it?"
Gibson unhooked the lantern from the chain over the stone slab and held it closer.
"I'd say this was the first wound," he said, pointing to the lowest slit. "That one got his stomach.
then of this one. He prodded the tip of one finger into the next cup.